This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Art by adolescents and an exhibit curated by adolescents gives you unexpected depth.
Some of them are very dark for teenagers. Usually they don't show the darker side. Like this one from Olivia is very, very sad.
17-year-old Jordan Davis says he's surprised at some of the children's works in the exhibit at the ISU galleries. Laura Kennedy has more. Plus, Eric Stock reports on how municipalities use social media. We have The View from France, a 16-year-old French high school student reflects on U.S. culture and community. And Mary Cullen runs down the economic indicators in Bloomington Normal by the numbers.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Social media has become a new frontier for government bodies to relay vital information to the public, but just as quickly and easily as it can inform and entertain, social media can also misinform and enrage. In part two of our series on the public's use of social media, GLT's Eric Stock looks into what happens when social media conversation goes off the rails.
One of the most popular Facebook pages locally is the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene. It has 22,000 likes, so when it posted a story about two women wanting to open a wine bar and bistro in downtown Bloomington called the Gypsy Room, it caught many people's attention, including the city council member for that part of Bloomington, Jen Carrillo. She replied to the post that the name Gypsy Room was racist and called for a boycott unless they changed the name. The owners of the proposed wine bar quickly replied they meant no harm and would come up with another name. Carrillo withdrew the boycott, but the firestorm was well underway. It spilled over into the city council chambers. Ruben Granados, another downtown Bloomington business owner, called out Carrillo during a recent city council meeting, saying she was setting a dangerous precedent.
In no way, shape, or form are the small business owners of Bloomington, and in particular Ward 6, going to stand by and allow this behavior from their own representative.
Carrillo says she can be both an advocate for racial justice and a strong advocate for small businesses in downtown. She later apologized to downtown business owners in a private meeting, but prior to that, she explained why she didn't reach out to the owners directly.
But I do think then we miss out on a broader community conversation where, you know, I had a lot of people reach out to me and say, I had no idea that that was a slur, and I'm really glad that this happened, so now I know moving forward.
Nate Carpenter runs the Social Media Analytics and Command Center, or SMAC Lab, at Illinois State University. He says government officials have been known to use social media to advance political causes, but he cautioned elected officials from turning it into a bully pulpit. He says you might win the battle, but you could lose the war.
There's power, but there's also responsibility that goes with that. And then also becoming involved in that space, she's going to see, the immediate backlash.
Carrillo declined to be interviewed for this story, but while explaining how she handled the matter to the media after a recent council meeting, Mayor Terry Renner intervened.
Like, I'm certainly open to learning and evolving what are the different ways to handle these things when they come up, but you know, I'm going to err on the side of being very public about issues that are of concern.
If I could just add something, I would just say, come on. You know, I mean, this is the kind of thing that nobody is harmed. Everybody's learned a lesson.
Renner has had a history of inflicting harm, sometimes on his own career, through words he said or posted online. The city council in 2015 censured him for calling a conservative blogger who was criticizing him a, quote, total piece of garbage, a sick, dirty, slimy, ignorant fool, and the craziest human being I've ever known. Renner at the time took full responsibility for those words, but says that's a part of his past now. He says people try almost daily to goad him into online fights over how the city is run.
There really have only been I think, two or three times where I've ever really engaged, and I've regretted it every time. But you definitely do when absolutely every piece of my schedule is FOIA'd all the time. Every single text message, every single email, every single telephone call, every single aspect of your life is FOIA'd, you know, Freedom of Information Act. Yeah, of course it's going to change what you do.
Renner says the newly elected council members recently underwent an extensive orientation involving all kinds of city business, but specifics on best practices for social media wasn't part of it. The city's communications manager, Nora Dukowicz, says the city doesn't try to manage what the mayor and council say or do online.
All in all, they can do what they want to do. They are a great resource for us in sharing the content that we create on our pages, which helps to, you know, spread the word for us. But generally, they do their own thing.
Elected officials generally have more leeway in how they wish to use social media. After all, they serve at the pleasure of the voters. And that became clear when McLean County adopted a social media policy in May. County Board Member Jacob Beard asked that 20 members of the board be exempt from the rules, and his colleagues obliged.
We clearly do not speak for the county. We speak for ourselves. And in communicating with constituents, we would not want to be limited in that way.
Elected office holders such as sheriff and treasurer have to follow the guidelines, but there's some gray area. The policy outlines disciplinary guidelines for violators, including dismissal, but it makes no mention of disciplinary action for elected officials who violate the code. Another gray area for elected officials is separating what content should be posted on an official government site and what's best left for someone's personal site. In the run-up to the elections last fall, McLean County Democrats had accused County Clerk Kathy Michael of improperly blocking users from the county clerk's official Facebook page. And just like the best ways to use social media are still evolving, so too are the laws guiding its use. Lisa Sornin is executive director of the State and Local Legal Center, a Washington, D.C.-based group that offers legal guidance to municipalities in matters which go before the Supreme Court. She says social media is still so new, there's no real legal precedent yet, and there might not be for decades, but we can glean from two recent appellate court cases. The 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia ruled in January that a county official in Virginia could not block a critic from an official government Facebook page. And in March, the Trump administration challenged a U.S. district judge's ruling last year that President Donald Trump couldn't block Twitter users from his official page. Sornin says for now, the courts are saying the First Amendment trumps government officials' wishes to censor negative comments.
A good rule of thumb is, does this speech just offend me? And if the answer to that question is yes, if it's just merely offensive, it probably has to be tolerated.
Sornin recommends elected officials separate their personal and government social media sites if they wish to exert control over who sees and can respond to their content.
Remember, when you're a government official and using social media on your government account, that this is your government account and the First Amendment applies.
County Clerk Kathy Michael won re-election, and shortly thereafter, the county clerk's Facebook page was taken down and has not been restored. Michael has since been using her personal page to post county clerk matters. While not unheard of, it is rare for a government official to rely solely on a personal page for official business. Michael declined to be interviewed for this story. Often the biggest nightmare for a social media manager is hitting post and then wanting to take it back. That happened in Normal recently when a town staffer replied on Facebook to a GLT story about a lawsuit filed against the town to stop an uptown development and save a mural. The town's response said, quote, "What a waste of tax dollars fighting a frivolous lawsuit." The poster went on to respond to other commenters about the story. The posts were quickly deleted, but Mayor Chris Koos acknowledged the damage was done.
The person that did it instantly knew that they'd made a mistake and had taken it down, but that shows you how many eyes are on Town or Normal page because a lot of people saw it.
Koos says the flap appears to have been caused by someone who was crossed up by Facebook's new administrator rules and mistakenly posted as a town administrator when they intended to post to their personal page.
It's just being more rigid about what you're posting and making sure you're posting on the right page.
The town later went to social media to apologize for the posting and said it was handling the matter internally. Koo says the town of Normal needs to do a better job combating what he calls misinformation online, and he considers social media one vehicle the town can use. What complicates that, the town's social media policy directs a communications manager to oversee it. The town eliminated that position last year. Koo suggests it's time the town bring that job back.
Our council has asked to have that position reinstated because of the need for corporate communications is important.
Social media will continue to evolve, but it seems clear it's never going away, and that worries some in the public sphere. Bloomington Mayor Renner admits he's not technology savvy. He'd much rather meet with someone face-to-face.
When you talk to somebody, you can tell tone, or if you're offended by something, you can immediately say, I'm offended by that. And you say, whoa, I didn't mean that, and then you can clarify, and then you walk away with a greater understanding.
Renner says social media has made us better connected, but in the process, we've lost understanding of each other. I'm Eric Stock.
For all its pitfalls, Normal Mayor Koos says social media can still be a government asset. He recently conducted an informal poll on his official Facebook page to get feedback whether those ever-present neighbor signs violate the town's sign code. Who says the town will look to change the code to ensure signs are legal, but he added it's not a priority.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the Midwestern floods have hampered barge traffic, and there's a proposal to address that. A report from IPR. Bloomington Normal wage growth may be lagging state and national averages, but local economists say that is not a cause for concern. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with Zach Dietmeyer of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council and Mike Doherty with the Illinois Farm Bureau about the impact of near-zero population growth and labor force shortages ahead of this quarter's BN by the Numbers event.
There are regional circumstances that contribute to that. We're not alone in some of these slower wage growths. I know the focus has been that it is slower than state or national levels, but I think from a local perspective, it's really dating back to May of 2018. It was, for lack of a better term, what I would call a pretty hard reset to some of the financial sector jobs, as you had a lot of higher wage employees and longer tenured employees leaving our local labor force. And they were being replaced, but they were being replaced at a much more of a beginner rate for those wages. And I think it's important to know that opportunity is still there for Bloomington Normal. We still have those jobs, albeit at a lower starting point. And I think that's where we're kind of attacking this from. This has been a really recent development for us as we've been digging into it from an economic development standpoint, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which tracks those numbers, had to do some updating in that side of things. And it takes almost a year to really get a full and fresh perspective on that. And we're right at that year point. So we're kind of trying to understand what our new normal is here locally for that labor participation. And obviously it's not good in that aspect, but with a younger population and a younger demographic than you see in most all of Illinois, I think it leaves us some opportunity to be successful if we can get all our ducks in a row.
It was interesting and new information about these average wage increases. So they divide, they take a whole quarter of, by survey, the salaries that are out there and the number employed, and they divide it. So a lot can shift around within that fraction. Like you don't know for sure, well, who's working at a whose average weight rate of gain is less, which sector. But in this case, in this report, they did break it out to financial sector. So you could see in the average wage gain by the finance sector for Bloomington Normal, there were 3 years in the last 10 that it was very low compared to the state average. And those 3 years is what pulled us down. It gave us a wage rate gain that was less than the state average.
May 2018 was where we saw a pivotal change, really. Let's zoom ahead here. Quarter one of 2019, comparing that to quarter one of 2018. In that small amount of time, we saw about 1,500 fewer jobs this year than last year, quarter one. Is this a ripple effect? Is this something that we should be worried about? Or is this just, the new normal?
I think it is more the new normal. There's so many factors that go into it. A big thing that we've talked about in the past when looking at this particular issue is retirements and those payouts for vacation and time accrued. That all got reflected about that May influx. So it made it look a little bit worse than I think it was at that point. But everything is out on the table now, as far as we can see for that. So it does reflect a similar story because of that year over year for the quarter. That's about a 2.5% decrease in our labor force. But what we've seen is that is steady for the last year. It's not a sudden downward spike. It was just a more or less a big blip on the radar, but it was a significant event that we will have to accumulate and really accommodate as we move forward. But you take a look at this month's preliminary unemployment rates, and we're back there right at the lowest point in Central Illinois with Champaign-Urbana. We're almost a full point ahead of Decatur, and we are ahead of Peoria at that rate, but it's still higher than that state average. It's still higher than that national average, and we're looking at how we're going to be able to attack this, not just from a Bloomington Normal or a McLean County perspective, but from a Central Illinois regional offensive as we go out and really try to, because these things affect us locally, but it starts to create, it's almost like one student getting the flu at school and suddenly the whole class has it. We have to find a way to combat this from a bigger and a stronger region that we have.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point. Looking at unemployment at a regional perspective rather than a statewide or a national perspective, could you explain a little bit how it's different looking at a statewide unemployment number compared to what we know as Central Illinois?
Well, our state is unique in that Illinois has the third or fourth largest city in the U.S., depending on how you're measuring it. And because of that, everything gets influenced that way. So Bloomington Normal essentially is a microcosm of the state of Illinois. If the statement goes, if Chicago catches a cold, the rest of us are sniffling and really impacted by that. But if we break it down into a regional aspect, it's a lot easier to see how we can fix these things for our area and to improve. Because obviously, as we know here, Bloomington Normal is not Chicago. And it's much more similar to the Champaign-Urbana or Decatur or Springfield markets. So we have that ability, and we in and of ourselves can kind of present the same front, maybe minus an international airport that Chicago has. So I think it's a better indicator for us locally to see how what our efforts in economic development or community development, how they're paying off as we see these numbers and can respond to them.
This dips a little bit into housing, which we'll be getting into next, but I want to talk about population growth and how that plays into unemployment and then how it plays into housing after that. So we have seen almost nil population growth locally. Is that right, Zach?
Essentially, and that gets into our demographic profile for the 2019 year. We track this annually, and as we approach the upcoming 2020 census, we'll have a much better feel for that. Old data is always better data, as we know, but we have enough of a trend here over the last 8 years since that came up. You look at pretty much all of our population. In 2010, for the last census, McLean County was at about 169,500 people. We're sitting at just under 173,000. So if you follow the growth projections and the tracks along that, they far exceeded what actually happened. And over the last year and a half, we've actually gone slightly down. We did peak at slightly over 173,000, and now we're down about 300 or 400 people. And as amazingly, you might say, out of that, our out-migration is still lower than our total. So we are overall growing in that trend, depending on how you measure that over a couple of year period. But it is important because, as we say at the EDC, and as we look for from a growth model and from a wealth generation model for our community, if you're not growing, you cannot stay stagnant. It is not an acceptable policy to maintain status quo. It just does not work, and that is not benefiting your community. That is not the way forward, and we're starting to see some of that impact. It's just like I've told to use another simpler analogy. If you don't water your plants at home, they're not going to continue to look the way they look now. So we're just out there trying to educate on that and continue to find new opportunities to strengthen, and a lot of that, if this is an indication, is it's going to have to come from within our community as we continue to build up from within.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Zach Dietmeyer with the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council and Mike Doherty with the Illinois Farm Bureau. So we just heard from Zach about how almost zero population growth is impacting the local economy. Mike, how about you tell us a little bit what's going on in the housing market? I know construction is down. Let's get into that a little bit.
Well, in fact, those population, that no growth population shows up in our housing market in a big way this year with a slight decrease in the existing home sales and a complete absence of new houses being closed on that were constructed. However, we've had a lot of rain to deal with. It's made it pretty tough to construct new homes and get them out there and get them sold. So a good portion of that poor performance in the new housing market in Bloomington Normal this spring through May may in fact be weather related. So we'll be watching this next quarter. We've seen this happen before where the market plays catch up over the summer. A couple years ago, it completely compensated for low sale. The market responded during the summer and completely compensated for a very low sales market during the winter and the early spring. So we'll be watching to see if that happens again. A bit contradictory is that the existing home prices went up. 5.3% increase in the average sale price for existing homes, which shows there's demand out there for those existing homes, despite the decrease in the number that actually sold. So it says to me that at least the income one needs in light of the mortgage interest rates, that helped a little bit too. They came down a little bit late in the spring. They peaked October through December or January, 30-year mortgage rates nationally, and they've come down a little bit since then. And I think that's probably helping us out there on those existing home prices, combined with holding on to whatever level of average income we had in that market for existing homes.
All right. Moving on to our last point of conversation today is retail sales. We're seeing opposite changes in Bloomington versus Normal. So it's looking like Bloomington had a reported 1% year-to-date increase. Normal, on the other hand, saw a decrease by about 0.25%. What's going on here?
Well, there you see the stagnation a little bit. You always look for these fringe indicators, and retail sales can be one of those to determine exactly how healthy our economy is. It just proves that, in a sense, we are healthy. We have money to be spending in the community, but it's not a growing factor. So it's not like we're diving off the table, and it's not all gloom and doom, but it's not all positive and upward trend as well. So I think we see that here. And the unfortunate part of this is you see category to category, it vultures itself in our communities a little bit when that happens, because where you see Bloomington go up, you'll see Normal go down in the same category. And it does lead to essentially net neutrality on that front. So it's a positive. It'll be very interesting, I I think to see how Bloomington's gas tax impacts this conversation as well. Automotive was especially productive for them in the first quarter. That can play into a lot of factors. First quarter of the year is typically where you see holiday sales, holiday travel, anything that did not get incorporated into reporting for December comes in January and February, as some organizations report later and get some of those details out there. So hard to really track quarter to quarter, but we'll be very interested to see how that's impacted in the coming months, as we could see some significant increases, not only in normal from some of the runoff if people are trying to escape that tax, but you're certainly going to see an increase from Bloomington as that tax takes effect.
We'll update these numbers, kind of look at them again before Thursday for the BN by the Numbers luncheon.
And also our speaker for this luncheon is Tom Frazier from the Bloomington Area Career Center. That plays directly into this data. We have the data. Now, what do we do with it? We know that we have to find a way to keep our young people in the community as our future workforce. And the best way to do that is to give them opportunities now, whether that be in hands-on activities, internships, externships, as the new catchphrase in the workforce development life, where it gives them opportunities to be out there and to get that hands-on experience. A lot of them learn that maybe what they were thinking for college was not what they want to do long-term, and that's a great opportunity for them to experience that now rather than accrue tons of debt and find out later when they jump into the workforce. So it's really highlighting what we're doing locally from that aspect. They do great work there. They have well over 1,000 students that they work with locally, and that number could be so much more if we focus in. And that's what we're really trying to do, is educate the community and show them that there are a lot of opportunities for us to pull and to boost these numbers that we've talked about, and they're all right here under our noses.
I guess my ending assessment is, as far as the labor force goes here and unemployment and total number of jobs, it's still a glass half full for Bloomington Normal in that we're stable. If you look at these 3.5-4% unemployment, not any really statistically not big changes year over year to labor force or employment numbers. So, at least we have that going for us.
That's GLT's Mary Cullen talking with Mike Dougherty of the Illinois Farm Bureau and Zach Dietmeyer of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. The Bloomington Normal by the Numbers event takes place tomorrow at Illinois State University.
Support for GLT comes from Town of Normal's Parks and Rec, inviting you to bring blankets and chairs to see the band Unfinished Business perform Saturday at 6 at the County Link Amphitheater. Complete concert series details at normalparks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Midwest agriculture depends on the Mississippi River to cheaply move grain and products, but high water has barges stranded. As Illinois Newsroom's Madeline Beck reports, that may actually be an opportunity for Illinois' southernmost city.
A standard river barge can hold 1,500 tons of product. In early June, about 640 of them sat on the river near American Commercial Barge Line's office outside Cairo, Illinois.
That's just me. That's not the other fleets in here.
That's Mark Glab, the facility manager there for ACBL. Its boats tow these barges full of fertilizers for farmers and steel up and down the river.
I get 3 or 4 calls a day with people wanting to be able to unload their barges here into trucks or into trains, because we can't go on the river until the water goes down.
The problem is, they can't unload at Cairo. There's no port. And this could be a growing problem as water levels trend upwards, keeping barges waiting longer.
The only difference this year is the length of time, but it seems to get worse every year.
And a port seems obvious. Cairo's near the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. It's near railroads and interstates. But previous Cairo port projects failed because of river or funding issues. The town is struggling. Larry Klein is chairman of the local Port Authority Board. He's also fourth-generation Cairo and has seen the town's booms and busts.
You know, you can understand never having nothing, but to have had everything and lost it all, something was wrong.
Cairo was once a hub of rural southern Illinois with more than 15,000 people. Many residents did well up into the 1950s, except the town's black community. They had no representation and few opportunities. During the 60s civil rights movement, they fought for equal rights. Boycotts sprang up, riots broke out, buildings burned. On top of it all, a new interstate bypassed the town completely. Misused funds, racism, and missed opportunities has left Cairo, Illinois, with about 2,000 people, no grocery stores, no gas stations, and in the last year, several hundred residents were forced to leave when their public housing units were condemned. Here's Klein again.
I've seen it in its heyday, and I see it today. And, well, it hurts. I want to stay around and say that, you know, I knew the people that help get us back on the right track.
An Illinois capital funding bill includes $150 million for port projects this coming year. Cairo asked for half that to build their port, but they'll compete against 18 other port districts. If they don't get enough money, Klein says they'll start to build port infrastructure to entice private investors. If they do get funds, people at Shawnee Community College say they can help train local kids to get jobs associated with the port. Kathleen Curfee is vice president of academic affairs there, and she's worked in port communities before.
We have developed captain's training, we have developed seaman's training, all the different many types of training that you will find as that port develops in the Carroll area.
Former Mayor Tyrone Coleman said in April that there's no limit to what this port could bring. Maybe a few trucking jobs here, then a gas station there, people moving back.
And that's the excitement of it all, is the unknown factor. Kind of like bring the past back, but at least bring it to a point where there is opportunity. And that's what's been lacking in this most southern part of Illinois over the years.
Still, this port could take 5 years to build if they get all the funding. And that's a big if with a $75 million price tag. But Klein argues the Cairo port is a solid business plan with barges waiting at their doorstep.
We just need a boost. I know there's others that do too, but we just feel like we've been forsaken.
The governor is expected to sign a capital funding bill in the next few weeks, which should show how port communities like Cairo vie to get their chunk of that $150 million. Madeline Beck, Illinois Newsroom.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Art by adolescents, curated by adolescents. Laura Kennedy has that report. And now the view from France. 16-year-old Olivia Machand lives in Paris. In the last several weeks, she's been staying with a host family in Bloomington Normal to improve her English language skill. Machand was kind enough to stop by the GLT studios for a brief interview. She tells us she's in high school.
In France, we graduate at 18 too, but what you call college, we call it a university. In France, we call college the school between 11 and 15.
Junior high school, we would call it.
Yeah.
What do you think of the U.S.?
It's pretty much how I imagine it. Like in the movies, we see some houses which are different, backyard. So, yeah, I imagine this. Because there are not a lot of people living in this city, everyone, like a lot of people, knows each other. I think it allows everyone to be more peaceful.
Contrast that to Paris, would you? Peaceful or not peaceful?
No, peaceful is not the word to describe Paris. Everyone is very busy, so like everyone is running. Like for example, in the underground, a lot of people just run and don't smile. And yeah, you don't get the chance to speak a lot with the people you meet.
Is that true of any large city, no matter the country, or is it unique to Paris, do you think?
I think it's, we can say it to every city, like big city.
How would you describe Paris to somebody who has never been there, who is living in a medium-sized town like Bloomington Normal?
I would say that Paris is, we call it a big city, but it's not as big as it, like, you can see a lot of monuments, but everything is very close. You can visit Paris in 4 days, but you just have to know where to go. You're never going to meet the people you know in the street. But you never, like, for someone, for a teenager or young adults or even adults, well, for everyone, there's always a lot of activities to do, and you never get bored. So I really like living there because I always some places to hang out with my friends.
Have you been bored in Bloomington Normal?
No, because my family is very nice, so we do a lot of stuff together and so on.
What have you liked most?
I don't have a favorite thing, but I like the way they live. So we often go and have dinner with their friends. So that's very nice because I can discover and meet a new person and yeah, the culture and so on. And I went to a ride on a bike. It was really nice because in Paris, I don't use the bikes often. Well, you can't really because it's very dangerous.
What have your impressions been of culture here in central Illinois? You mentioned culture as something that you had a chance to become familiar with. How would you describe American culture to Americans from your perspective as a young French woman?
I think they don't have the same way of living as I know because... yeah, for example, they have lunch at noon. In France, we do too, but it's not that strict. And we have dinner around 8 or 9, and here it's around 6, so that's very early, because around 4 and a half, we have a snack. So, yeah, that's quite different.
What food do you like the best here?
I would say the... junk food, like the peanut butter, because we don't have it in France, the like candies, the Reese's and so on.
Mm-hmm. What do you have instead of peanut butter? Are there other nut butters that you do have, a hazelnut or anything like that?
Yeah, Nutella. Okay. Everyone eats it.
And what food that you have encountered in America do you like the least?
I eat the bread.
Okay. Why not?
Why not? Because I come from Paris, so it's difficult to like the bread of other places.
Well, you have so many good choices there.
Yeah.
So you want to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been able to see anything medical here in the U.S.?
Yes, I've been shadowing Dr. Jack Caprice. He's an oral surgeon. I've been shadowing him 2 mornings.
What did you learn?
A lot of things. I wasn't expecting that. Really, because it was really rude, the way they were taking off out the teeth. So I passed out. But then when I was feeling better, I just came back, and it was really, really interesting. And they described me a lot of stuff. I learned a lot.
That early impression, that the fainting that you did, does not chill your desire to be a doctor, though.
No, at all.
Okay. What kind of doctor do you think you might like to be?
A surgeon.
So you'll get used to the blood, I guess.
Yeah.
But perhaps not oral surgery or less oral surgery?
Not oral surgery because it's too little. I want to work on a more global area. I don't know if you get me, but I don't want to work in the mouth.
In the United States, becoming a doctor is a long process, and you not only have to go to university, then you have to go to medical school after that. How does that work in France?
Yeah, it's the same. Since I was 8, I want to be a surgeon, and everyone says me that it's a very hard work, and you have to study a lot. And yeah, I think to be a surgeon is 11 or 12 years of studies, but I guess if you're interested in what you do, then you will enjoy it, so mm-hmm. That's fine.
The Women's World Cup football tournament or soccer tournament is in France right now. The United States is competing, and everyone is looking to France because mm-hmm. The French are viewed as the home team and an accomplished team. Do you follow football at all?
Yep, but okay. The boys.
Boys football, yeah. Okay. So what's your favorite team? Paris Saint-Germain?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So who's going to win the next World Cup for the men, do you think?
I think Spain or France. Like, I want them to win.
What are your impressions of U.S. politics?
Well, the United States is a big, big country, and so obviously it's the most, well, everyone is looking at the America as the biggest country in the world and the biggest economy. So in France, nobody likes Donald Trump. Yeah, everyone is quite shook that such a big country could be run out with a president which is like this.
Are there similarities in American and French politics, though? Trump has been a populist person, and in France there is Marie Le Pen, also a populist and agitating from the right. So why do you think both countries have some of the same themes in politics right now?
Because the same politics have been elected too long, too much time. So the people begin to be like disappointed by them because our society is not going very well. So they need and want a change. They are willing to try the extreme part of the politics so that they could discover a new way of run out the country.
Olivia Machon goes to a private Catholic school in Paris. She's been working on her English this summer during a stay in Bloomington Normal. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The director of the University Galleries in Uptown Normal recently turned over curating control to a group of students from Bloomington High School. That unique arrangement is actually part of a new teen arts organization that aims to help young people learn that there's more to visual art than just paints and brushes. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
15, 16, 17, 18 is the age range of the artists who created the works in the latest exhibition at the University Galleries. That's also the age range of the curators of the show, which features selections from the International Collection of Child Art at Milner Library. The exhibition is the start of what's hoped to be an ongoing effort to give artistic agency to area young people. That's according to Kendra Pates, director and chief curator of the galleries. With support from a grant from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, the inaugural Teen Arts Group has shown BHS students the possibilities of a career in visual arts. After years of tours for K-12 students, Pates says the Teen Arts Group was a natural choice.
A lot of high school students had been reaching out after they would have a tour with their classes here about doing an internship or volunteering. You know, when I was growing up, I knew you could be an artist, an illustrator, or an art teacher, which are all awesome, wonderful professions, but I didn't know that there were all of these other paths you could follow.
I had no idea there was such a thing as a curator when I was a kid.
Right, me either, or a conservator, or a registrar, or a preparator. And so throughout the course of the program, the students have had an opportunity to meet with professional artists, to look at studios, to look at collections. We took a field trip to Chicago.
17-year-old Katie Novotny is partial to painting in oils. She says she has a real passion for art and that being in the teen art group has certainly been fun, but there was serious intent behind her desire to be involved.
It really has helped me gain a perspective on some of the other options that I could possibly work in. I do want to pursue studio arts as a possible option, but this just helps me in order to be more involved in the community itself.
Grace Marcy just finished her junior year at Bloomington High. The 17-year-old likes to paint, draw, and is interested in graphic arts. She says the opportunities for artists in public school are limited and so embraced this opportunity.
So this was really a great way to do something outside of your typical art high school group and being able to experience things like the Chicago trip and working with materials like the International Child's Art Collection. Being able to work with materials like that was really just a great opportunity to expand myself as an artist.
A train trip to Chicago gave the students a chance to meet artist Juan Chavez, who Pates says followed an untraditional path to success.
He immigrated here from Mexico when he was 13. He actually didn't graduate from the Art Institute. He said that he couldn't meet the language requirements, but later they invited him back to be a professor. And he's incorporated skateboarding into his work and public participatory projects using found objects. So that was really exciting to see them just kind of hanging out with this artist and asking him questions.
The culminating project of the year-long Teen Arts program was an exhibition completely curated by the participants. Pate said the approach was to let the teens curate work from artists in their own age group. Milner Library's International Collection of Child Art was a natural resource. The collection was started in 1960 to celebrate the creativity of children through a global perspective. The collection holds over 8,000 works from more than 50 countries. 17-year-old Jordan Davis is a photographer who enjoys catching candid shots. Davis was surprised by some of the children's art in the collection.
Some of them are very dark for teenagers. Like, that's not surprising, but usually they don't show the darker side. Like, this one from Bolivia is very, very sad.
One of the more somber-looking works is a print called My Brother, depicting a figure with head and hands. The photographer in Davis was drawn to the captured moment that invites interpretation.
I just like the idea, like, capturing someone when they're not looking, you know what I mean? You don't realize how you come off. Like, they might be chilling, they just relaxed, but the way they were captured, they look very upset. And you never know the story behind it. They could have lost somebody they loved. They could have failed a math test, you know what I mean?
Gallery director Kendra Pates says that the art selected for the exhibition tended to reflect the personality of the students doing the choosing.
And for me, it was, as somebody who's a curator, it was particularly exciting to see how these students looked at all of these different selections, narrowed it down, and made these really cohesive hangings out of them. You know, you can see in a lot of these instances why they picked specific works. You know, you were just talking to Jordan and you can see a real interest in social issues and social justice just by looking at the five works that she selected.
Whereas Jordan Davis was drawn to the darker side, Katie Novotny embraced bright works.
To me, color, like bright colors really catch my eye, and so that's just something I was looking for while selecting the pieces. I'm also drawn to like nature and landscapes and things like that. So that's some of what you can see in the pieces I've chosen.
Grace Marcy went for art that really reflected the type of artist she is.
I'm a very clean, I feel like, organized artist. I like to call myself the organized artist. So I like a lot of like the clean works, and I like to look at color a lot. So this is actually mine. I wanted to pull from both of those. So like the bridge, I really liked the colors and then also the children, but then using like the other three, I really liked how they were a lot more clean and organized, like I said.
Once the artworks were selected, Pate said the students had the opportunity to decide just where in the huge university galleries the exhibition would be shown.
A few months ago, we walked around all of our spaces and talked about which ones were possibilities and talked about the pros and cons of putting the exhibition in each of the different spaces. They chose this space and they talked through a lot of different ideas. At one point, they thought about painting stripes on the wall to sort of delineate different sections for each of them. And as we got closer, they thought they liked this really clean, light gray that we have throughout the gallery.
Now that the show is open to the public, student curator Jordan Davis feels the artwork can provide insight into the minds of young artists and lead to something more.
Sometimes teenagers don't have a voice, and they need a way to express themselves, to tell their side of the story. You know what I mean? Adults get to tell their sides all the time. Sometimes they gotta speak the truth.
What do you think the adults will get out of coming to see this show?
Maybe understanding how they feel. So, like, sometimes you can't talk to your parents. Like, maybe I should actually talk to my children, you know what I mean?
Grace Marcy agrees that the exhibition provides a window into the teen creative mind, which she feels deserves more attention.
I feel like art is such a child expression. That's our first way of expressing ourselves. And as we grow older, I feel like a lot of us lose that a little bit. And so having the progression from child to adult with your art, it's really great to see like the teenager's perspective of art, because I feel like that's sometimes what we overlook.
While the show curated by the Teen Art Group runs, in adjacent galleries, there are shows curated by professionals. Having their work alongside makes Katie Novotny feel as though the teens are on equal footing.
I just think teenagers have a lot of talent and a lot of passion, and sometimes they don't get as much credit or exposure as more experienced, well-known artists, adult artists. So it was just really nice to be able to show some of the work that they did in the same way they would a professional artist.
Gallery director Kendra Pates says the most important thing for her was to give the students artistic agency.
Young people are brilliant and creative, and they just don't always have the most outlets to showcase that. They have a phenomenal art teacher at BHS in Monica Esterbrook. She's brought her students in many times, and so when I had this idea, she was the first teacher that I reached out to about partnering, and so she really helped work through kind of the paperwork side of it too. You know, what are the permissions we need for working with young people and for bringing them back and forth to the gallery, for taking them on a field trip to meet an artist, to see shows, to meet with graphic designers in their new office.
And as the students were learning, Pates was learning from them, trying to get a sense of what the inaugural group responded to.
I think if we're going to do this, it has to be guided by the students and by their needs.
15, 16, 17, 18, BHS selects from the International Collection of Child Art, remains up at the University Galleries through July 28th. Kendra Pates says the galleries received another grant to continue the teen art group. So when the new school year begins, a new group of students will experience firsthand what it means to make a life in the world of visual arts. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See a photo gallery of the exhibition at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.